Our next speaker is going to be Ken Wolgemuth. Did I get that right? Okay.
Very good. Congratulations.
Okay. And he is an adjunct professor at the University of Tulsa and a BioLogos blog author. He and Greg Davidson at the University of Mississippi, they're both in geology and engineering and both BioLogos authors. And today, Ken is going to talk about some really exciting work, I think, on carbon dating, the 800 carbon 14 measurements in a lake in Japan, and how that relates to understanding young Earth models. All right.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm glad to be here. Come to a number of these ASA meetings, and they were always incredibly inspiring. Greg Davidson and I have written a couple of papers about Lake Tsiogetsu, and this one is an update where we now have more than double the carbon 14 analyses than we had about 5 to 6 years ago, that when we prepared some of those papers. So, tidal connection, measurable carbon 14 in ancient samples just do not support a young Earth, so we want to comment about that. And how can we verify historical science? In this case, I'm using the example of radiocarbon. Let me pray and ask God's blessing over my time here together with you. Dear Lord, I thank you for that you have provided such awesome tools for us as scientists to look at your creation and observe the evidence for the passage of time. Please help me to prepare and present this particular example of radiocarbon so that the listeners here can understand. In the name of Jesus, amen. Carbon-14 is produced in the upper atmosphere by cosmic rays interacting with nitrogen. Once the carbon-14 is produced by that step, it gets into the carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere. Trees and plants take up the carbon dioxide in the process of photosynthesis. Animals eat the plants, and so the radiocarbon gets into the bones of the animals. When we get samples that have been, once the animals and the plants die, then that radioactive carbon begins to decay away with its characteristic half-life. If the production of radiocarbon in the upper atmosphere has remained constant over the last 50,000 years, and if in fact that half-life is 5,730 years as we measure it and understand it, this is an idealized decline curve that would describe the decay of radiocarbon over the life of back to about 50,000 years. If we get a bone from the mammoth and it has 6% of modern carbon down from the 100% that it had when it was living, we can take that point, come here to the graph, and recognize that that animal lived 23,000 years ago. And this is the evidence for that. Young Earth challenges made to this process include that the conventional assumptions that we applied in terms of half-life production in the atmosphere are not testable, that the decay rates of carbon-14 were faster in the past, that the carbon-14 buildup in the atmosphere occurred only after the flood, and that there are measurable amounts of carbon-14 in samples that we recognize from other methods are ancient, in the millions of years, but in fact, they claim that that measurable carbon-14 is evidence for a young Earth. These are the models we're going to test today. The context of a young Earth model is that carbon-14 was reduced to almost zero at the time of the flood about 4,400 years ago. So all of this data that goes back beyond the ordinary conventional understanding are sediments that were deposited by Noah's flood. So that denies the context of the passage of period of time out of our conventional understanding. To test these two different models, we're going to use a combination of independent methods, and I'm going to start with tree rings. Tree rings, as you know, grow annually as a tree grows, and it's possible for geologists to extend the tree ring count back in time beyond living trees by a step that we refer to as cross-dating. As is logical, when we have a very wet season, the width of a tree ring tends to be wide or broad, and in a dry season, those will tend to be narrow. So we can use, on a dead tree, we can use a pattern of wide and narrow bands from the seasonal variation, compare it to the living tree, seek a match, sort of like a barcode match, and extend the tree ring count back into the past. The young earth challenges to these questions are that tree rings can actually grow multiple rings per year, and that the cross-dating step of comparison of the dead tree rings to the living tree are coincidental matches in that process. That's the ordinary decline curve if there were no variations of carbon-14 production in the atmosphere. In fact, since the early days of Willard Libby's work on radiocarbon and developing the methodology, the science community has known, in fact, that the flux of cosmic rays from the sun do change with time. There's some variability, and so we have to adjust for that and accommodate that and develop methods to understand that variation. Using other radioisotopes that are also produced in the atmosphere, it's understood that for the last several thousand years before present, the production of radiocarbon would be somewhat less than it is today. About 50,000 years ago, those other isotopes indicate that the production was possibly as high as double what it is today. So in this diagram, we've drawn two lines that form a boundary that account for expectations for that variation. The lower line is drawn assuming the production is 95% of modern carbon today. So that's the lower boundary. The upper boundary, the upper line, is considering a straight line increase in the production in the atmosphere from 100% today back to 200% back at 50,000 years. And so the upper line represents the decay that would be result in what we would expect to see today. So that forms sort of limits of what a conventional understanding of this would count and provides the ability then to test these two different models. I'm going to zero in on trees first because the tree ring count goes back to about 12,000 years. So I'm zeroing in on that segment. If there were many rings produced per year, they would fall above that band of expectations for conventional understanding. If there were less carbon-14 produced in the atmosphere or much faster decay rates, then the results would fall below the line. If in that cross-dating process we accidentally made errors visually of comparing those sort of the barcode style, the result would be that a set of the data would fall below the line. It would not match the next tree ring pattern that we have. So just the physical measurement of the amount of C14 in the rings gives us an opportunity to confirm that, yes, we've done the cross-dating method appropriately. And in fact, those two sets of tree rings grew in the same years. All right. What do the results show from tree ring patterns for the last 12,000 years? Ta-da! Fall within our expectations, so affirmation that on average, these fit a conventional model. So the option for Greg Davidson and me is that God has really given us some pretty awesome tools to verify that 12,000 tree rings can be appropriately considered the passage of 12,000 years. But there could be an option too, that God has precisely altered three independent natural phenomena: the tree ring growth per year, the atmospheric production of carbon-14, the decay rate of carbon-14, to falsely match that conventional expectation. I offer a question to you. As Christians, does that option represent the character of God as we see him described in Scripture? Now we'll go further back in time and include Varves into the story. There's the location of this lake, Suigetsu, that I'll be showing you diagrams and data from, on the north side of the island. In the springtime, species of diatoms, as they grow and bloom in the spring, deposit a white layer of their shells on the lake bed, and then in the rest of the year, dark sediments deposit and fill in on top of the white. So we get alternating bands of light and dark and light and dark down through the sedimentary section. Here are a couple of photographs that show some of those laminations, but you can see here they've been interrupted by some floods that have happened in that area. There's an example of an evidence of earthquake that slushed some more material from the sides of the lake down onto the lake bed. And there's a piece of tephra from a volcanic eruption. There's a photograph of a piece of a tree leaf, and the data that I'm showing you has been from doing the radiocarbon analysis of about 800 pieces like this of portions of tree leaves, or some of the data comes from twigs. Here's a graph now that shows the carbon-14 content of about those 800 analyses from the top of the core at the lake bed down to a depth of about just a little less than 40 meters. And the carbon-14 here has dropped down to its background level. Notice that the data is represented by black circles here on the left-hand side, and in the central section here described as finely layered couplets, those are in green. You can also see in the diagram that there are laminations evident in this photograph or this diagram, but down to 12 meters, those couplets of annual layers have been eliminated because bottom-dwelling organisms are there mixing up the light and dark bands. So sections of these cores are not laminated, do not have the sedimentary barbs. And that's one of the questions that we work to deal with. In the barbed section that we have confidence that there are the annual couplets, then the question is, do in fact 31,000 of those couplets actually apply to the passage of 31,000 years? So we have to do some testing. Are the couplets annual? And do we have confidence in that? Another diagram that shows some of the multiple years, about 8 years of passage of time there. Back beyond the end of the decay of carbon-14, then that time goes on into the past. Here from a young Earth model, very low carbon-14 content is described as depositing all of these as flood deposits. The data from carbon-14 here in the sedimentary barbs is considered to result from a rapid rise in carbon-14 content in the atmosphere after Noah's flood 4,400 years ago. So here's the section then that we have, section that does not have barbs. Here's the section where we have the sediment couplets of 31,000 years. We need to put together, at this point, I want to put together the nature of the tree ring data in addition. So there's the varved sediments from the lake. Here is the time period over which tree ring record is available from present back to 12,000 years. And you will notice that there is some overlap. That overlap ends up in the fact that we don't have barbs in this upper portion of the sedimentary core gives us both a limitation, but yet also an advantage and an opportunity. The limitation is we don't have barbs to count. The opportunity is that we can do some comparison at that overlapping interval. So on the left-hand side is the tree ring data, and representing 5,000 tree rings for 5,000 years. On the right-hand side is the sedimentary varves from the lake, and I'm going to adjust the scale on the right-hand side because so that this scale of 5,000 varves is equal in size of my diagram to 5,000 tree rings. The next step then is to collect that data and put it together. And voila, the sedimentary varve data in this overlap section matches quite well with the tree ring data. This kind of result gives us that opportunity to test, because if, let's see the next slide, yeah, okay. If the fact that these match so nicely and this remarkable fit, that this is only possible if tree rings are in fact annual and if the sedimentary varves are annual. So it's a confirmation that those two are true. Plus, it gives an affirmation that the decay rates and the production in the atmosphere is according to the conventional understanding as we have it. Now, this data and this crossover time period also gives us the opportunity to begin the point of counting the varves. And you'll notice here in particular in this rather steep section, there's a particularly a good fit, and statistically the research group found that the best fit to that whole set of data comes at 11,240 years. So at this point, calibration curves shift from the tree ring data to the varve data to put the package of the data together. So here on the larger scale, going back to 50,000 years, we see the tree rings, and that's the area of overlap that I've just been showing you. If there were many couplets in those sedimentary cycles that were done per year, the data would not fall between our band of expectations for conventional understanding. If they were lower in carbon-14 in the past than expectations, that would plot below the line. If there was a segment of the sedimentary cores that the researchers that collected them missed a continuous section, it would show up in the radiocarbon data. It would make an offset indicating that there are missing barbs. So what does the data look like? From what I've been saying, you can make a good guess. Voila. It fits nicely into conventional expectations and not fitting the young Earth model. The same pair of options, God gives us some awesome tools to verify that these Sui Getsu couplets are indeed annual and therefore barbs, and that the radiocarbon record goes back to about 50,000 years. The other option to consider is that God precisely altered four independent natural phenomena: tree ring growth per year, sedimentary couplets per year, atmospheric production of carbon-14, and the decay rate of radiocarbon. Again, to falsely match what we get from conventional expectations, and I ask the same question, does this false appearance represent the character of God that we see in the Bible? Now, the claim is made that the last thing we want to test Well, in my opinion, I think those things have adequately tested and confirmed a conventional model compared to a young Earth model. But the claim is made that these sediments back in the past were, in fact, flood deposits, and the conventional understanding is that is below resolution. So now I'm going to show just the data from about 50,000 years on back and elaborate on what the researchers did. This is the tail end of the sedimentary varves, and notice that the scale here is this is all below 1% of modern carbon, so we're just dealing with the very bottom end. There's the detection limit considered from the equipment in the laboratory. The research team took about 50 samples that were deep in the core, down considered to be 80 or 90,000 or more years below, and took them to the laboratory and treated those as getting an understanding of background. So laboratory work includes background when there are inherent methods in the analysis that need to be corrected. To use an analogy, think about using a piece of cloth and you want to clean a dirty window. You take the cloth, you begin to wipe, you wipe off all the dirt that you see, but there'll be a few fibers from the cloth that will stick on the glass. You continue to do that for the rest of the window and there's still some fibers left on the glass. We have sources of contamination in the radiocarbon samples that we're preparing. Groundwater can percolate into the coal and leave some carbon-14 behind. Bacteria and insects can dig into the wood or the bones and be there. So the laboratory process is aggressively using some chemicals to try to clean out and get rid of, sort of like the dirt on the window, to clean out the excess potential contamination. For a sample to be analyzed for carbon-14, it has to be converted from the tree leaf material or the bone to graphite to put it into the equipment. To test what graphite would yield to get to the limits of the methodology, we find some very old ancient graphite, measure it without the pretreatment, and we get a value very close to that measurement limit. If the same material, the same graphite, of which we did this before, is measured after the pretreatment, we get analyses in the range of 0.3 to 0.4% modern carbon, hence a background node. And there are the numbers involved, the 3,000th measurement limit, and then the 0.3. What are our options? God gave us some pretty awesome tools to verify that ancient samples do not have intrinsic radiocarbon. Or God precisely picked atmospheric carbon concentration at the time of the flood. He timed the discovery of radiometric dating, radiocarbon dating methods to ensure that it would falsely look just like laboratory background. Or another way that I appreciate that Greg wrote it, and I'm just going to say it, said another way, why would God set the carbon-14 content at the time of the flood at 0.5% modern carbon and the discovery of radiocarbon dating at just under one half-life so that actually measured carbon-14 still has fossil samples that falsely look like laboratory background? Thank you very much for your kind attention, and it's time for questions. Now, before the first question, please, I want to assure you all that we already have a paper written on this whole story, on this whole, what I'm showing you. And it's in draft form. Greg has written it. I've spent 3 or 4 days going through it. We have edits. So we think it'll be available and ready within 1 to 2 to 3 months. So just FYI. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Ken.
Yep.
I missed the first 2 or 3 minutes. I apologize.
That's fine.
Where did the 95% to 200% range come from? And then secondly, it looks like in the tail end of the things, it seems closer to the 200% than sort of smack in the middle. So can you comment on the reason and why you expect that?
Knowing that the carbon-14 content in the atmosphere from cosmic ray production does vary, and we've known it varies.
They've used some other radioactive isotopes that are also produced. I think there was a beryllium one. I don't remember which one.
Beryllium-10.
They've used that. And they recognize that with beryllium-10, we've had somewhat less, something like 95% of modern carbon in the last several thousand years. And the beryllium-10 is an indication that the production back almost 50,000 years is like 60 to 70 to 80% more. So Greg just made a selection to do a straight line interpolation for the increase back in time. Down at the low level, I would suggest that the uncertainty is small enough, because you're talking about within all that's within the 1% modern carbon.
Thank you.
Yeah? Somebody else? You.
I think he had his hand up first.
Fine. Thank you. I'm sorry. That's your deal, not mine.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
So how much like spatial variation, or depending where you are on Earth, is there much spatial variation in the production of carbon for concentration in the atmosphere?
Around the Earth?
Yeah, I'm just curious.
To my knowledge, in the atmosphere, probably not for our purposes.
Okay,
probably not. Now, in different locations where the carbon-14 is taken into materials, the answer is yes. Because if the carbon dioxide has to go into the seawater, and then there are shells in the seawater that produce shells, those have what we call a reservoir effect. The beauty of Suigetsu, and the reason the radiocarbon community is so excited about it, is they're using leaves directly from the trees that were living around the lake. Now that they have a very good record, this data is now included in what's called NCAL-13. NCAL is the reference name that the radiocarbon uses for their calibration curves, and they update it every 2 or 3 years.
So I apologize, I missed the very beginning, but I was wondering, and you may have just answered in part, why Lake Suigetsu, and getting greedy, are there other places like that?
Yes. The unique thing about Suigetsu is that, in fact, the promotional material is referred to by the team as the Miracle Lake. Now, that I'm not, the word there, miracle, is not what we mean. It's a miracle as Christians. And Helen already decided I will never put that word into a paper or anywhere that I'm communicating. I'm sharing that word with you because I'm here to explain. Okay. Here's the thing about Suigetsu. For instance, in Minnesota, there's a lake, and in one of our previous papers, we had some of that, Steel Lake, some of that data. It only goes back to 10,000 years. So the thing about Suigetsu and the uniqueness that I couldn't explain in this time window is that it's a series of several small lakes, and the river flows into the lake before this one in the drainage system, and so big, huge river flow flood stage does not push into Suigetsu. It's got this big trap, and what gets over in the Suigetsu is minor compared to what's over in this. And I've seen a photograph after a rain in the other lake, Makata, upstream or up drainage basin, is brown. Suigetsu is clear. Does that answer the question? I think that was the one. Why unique? Other places around the world?
Yes.
Lake-wise, not that I've heard of. Lake-wise. Now, there are full sediment to 50,000-year records in a marine setting, like offshore Venezuela. There's a Cariaco Basin, and there you get all 50,000 years. But there has to be that correction going through a marine step, not directly leaves.
In the back, over
here? Yeah.
I have a question whether above ground nuclear explosions since 1945 that might produce a little bit of carbon-14 are an issue. And secondly, if I may, are there radioactive decay processes going on underground that would produce small amounts of carbon-14 in the ground?
The answer to both is yes. The production of bomb testing did produce enormous quantities of carbon-14, and so there's a huge spike up to about double, about double the general burden in the atmosphere. That's been known, and now that has declined since the discontinuation, since the, you know, stopping the production, stopping the nuclear testing. All this data and everything the radiocarbon community talks about is referenced to 1950. Okay, so that when that percent modern carbon, 100%, that was what was understood to be in the atmosphere in 1950. So that's the nuclear test. What was the other test? Oh, underground. The answer is yes. Uranium decay and some of the other decay products that throw out nuclear particles can produce very trace amounts of carbon-14 below the surface. So this is not 100%. That amount, the radiocarbon community considers rare enough not to be of great consequence. Now, it's one of those issues that when we develop our arguments against the young Earth interpretation or countering the common interpretation, that's one of those that comes into play. Today, I'm just showing you the cleaning process.
Let's just take one more very, very quick question.
How do you understand the 6 days God's creation in Genesis 1, the Earth is very old? Is that day is 24 hours?
I want to do that offline, because
okay.
That's not carbon.
We'll do that.
I'll do that. You talk to me directly. I'll be glad to.
Okay.
Any other science?
I think that
that's
we have
fine.
To wrap that up.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.